I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. One of the things that people sometimes get confused on is what our program is all about. They assume that the conversations might all be between members of different faiths seeking common ground, and admittedly, that's how we started. In those early days, I wasn't hosting it, but I did have a hand in helping to produce and I procured guests. But we've evolved to a point where the parameters for subject matter have widened considerably. When we say that we are an interfaith dialogue, what we mean now is that we explore the vast world of religion in the public square, in politics, psychology, education, family life, etc., with guests who come from a variety of spiritual backgrounds, or no religion at all. And one of the things I love about hosting these proceedings is how I come upon the fine folks who agree to share their wisdom with us. Well, recently, I discovered the discipline of sociology and religion, and a sociologist who specialized in religion. When I invited him to be on the show, he was rather hesitant. He thought that because his interest was in the social science that observed religious behavior, instead of representing a religious tradition itself, he would disappoint. I told him that Common Threads was looking for, among other things, exactly what he was studying. Still, I couldn't convince him to join us, but I'm very grateful to the woman who is waiting in the wings who did agree to share thoughts on her field. Dr. Laura Olson is past president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion and a professor of political science at Clemson University. She's a native of Racine, Wisconsin. She earned her BA and MA in political science from Northwestern University and her PhD from the University of Wisconsin. She has served as a visiting research fellow at the Center for the Study of Religion at Princeton. Her research focuses on contemporary religion, civic engagement, and American politics, and has placed special emphasis on the political attitudes and behaviors of clergy. Her work has appeared in leading scholarly journals, including Political Research Quarterly, Social Science Quarterly, and the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. So we welcome to Common Threads, Dr. Laura Olson. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Fred. Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. So let's introduce everyone to the wonderful, wacky world of sociology and religion. So I'm going to assume when we hear that a new Pew Research poll has come out indicating that the percentage of Jews in the country went this way, Pentecostals went that way, was that the work done by sociologists such as yourself or your colleagues?
Yeah, by social scientists more generally, sort of construed. So obviously social science would include political scientists, sociologists, demographers, economists, anthropologists. But the folks at Pew, a lot of them have background in specific, in the religion portion of Pew, have background in the sociology of religion, some in political science, like religion and politics. And all of them are experts in empirical analysis of the relationship between religion and, as you indicated before, public life in general.
And how do the different disciplines get along? Because I've dealt with academics long enough to know that sometimes this department isn't completely on the same team as this other department, and they have different ways of looking at things and different ways of coming to conclusions. But would you say in your field that in general there is consensus that you know your methodology is just as good as somebody who is an anthropologist, because you're a political scientist. So, you know, do things work out in the end?
You know, like anything in human life, it depends, right? It depends on the individual. It depends on what university or college we're talking about. But generally speaking, in our field, so the institute or the organization that I was president of, the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, brings together folks from these different social scientific, various different social scientific disciplines. And our organization is probably about half sociologists and half folks from other disciplinary homes. There's some differences of opinion in terms of, you know, what's the exact appropriate method for studying, empirically studying, that is, how religion intersects with different pieces of social life. Some people, I'd say, half to two-thirds of the folks who study religion and politics empirically, in the West anyhow, do so from a quantitative standpoint, that is, gathering survey data, analyzing survey data, and sometimes various other related methods, but that's the main thing that quantitative scholars would do. And then other folks do, and some, by the way, some do both quantitative analysis and also fall into the category I'm about to describe, which is qualitative analysis, where you might go interview elites, you might go become a participant in a particular religious setting and study it while you are part of it. But bottom line, you're looking in qualitative approaches to understanding religion. You're looking for depth, whereas in quantitative analysis, you're looking for breadth. So if I do a survey of a couple thousand people, I know a little bit about a whole lot of people. If I do, if I spend a year somewhere studying in depth how, people within different Christian traditions in a European country do or don't get along with one another, or how they welcome the stranger, et cetera, et cetera. I know a whole lot about a relatively small number of people, right? So the ideal way, in my own opinion, is to use a little bit of both. And as a field, that's exactly what we do. So some folks would be much more sort of on the quantitative side and would argue that this is the best sort of way of knowing. Others would say, no, we need to do qualitative analysis and really understand people's sort of felt experience with religion in a deep, sort of specific kind of way. But at the end of the day, if you bring all that together, you're getting from a variety of different scholars both that breadth and that depth.
I know that I've addressed this with academicians before, so tell me how this works in your field. The difference between people, lettered, very intelligent, very accomplished people who have degrees in anthropology or social science, sociology, etc., and some of them are adherents to a religion and others are not. Is there, do you ever see any conflict between those two groups?
I haven't seen much, within any field, right? With any workplace or any field of study or any broad profession, our group, right, so to speak, is relatively small. And so, I as an individual might know another scholar as an individual and know sort of about their life and about their, religious commitments, their family, whatever. But at a more macro level, in terms of whether or not someone's coming from a personally religious standpoint versus not, or if we're talking about different kinds of approaches to personal religion and how that affects scholarship, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that there's no tension ever at all, but would I at the same time argue that differences in personal background has hindered our field in substantial ways? No.
You've been involved in a number of published works. One of them, did you not contribute to the publication Faith Matters, Religious Affiliation and Public Opinion About Barack Obama's Foreign Policy in the Greater Middle East? Am I correct?
Yes.
That leads me to ask, Is the interest and the intelligence about the various world religions greater now than it was in the recent past? I gather that it is. I gather that the government all of a sudden decided they needed to know more about the various religions of the various world regions that we have interchange with, and sometimes not pleasant interchange with. But I don't have any information to back me up on that. This is something that I think I've observed. Am I observing correctly or not?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. And we could talk about how that's true from both in terms of elites, right? People who work for government, people who comprise government, and then ordinary people, right? The masses. So let me take the sort of elite level first. And this is true in the U.S., and it's true, obviously, all around the world as well, on the part of other governments. It's just easier to know about the variety of religions that we see around the globe and how those play out and how different people in different countries and in different religious traditions experience religion and what they do about religion, both in terms of, you know, how it plays out in society and how it might impact upon politics, whether domestically or in terms of foreign policy. So, yep, you absolutely, the United States government knows way, way more now about and appreciates way, way more the variety of religions that exist around the world. And that's because, of course, the world's gotten smaller. I mean, not physically, obviously, right? But we because of not just the internet, but, you know, in the past 100 years or so, we've had the opportunity to get to know, right, what the variety of religious life looks like around the world in a way that was very, very difficult as recently as 100 or so years ago. And of course, it's as a result, it's more important to understand different religious traditions from around the world, not just because we're able to, but because if we think about, you know, globalized trade, we need to understand, okay, so if we're going to be engaged in trade with India, we need to understand something about Hinduism and Islam and, right, how they interact with one another, let's say, in the context of India. But also, if we're, like, for example, if we're talking about Islam in India, like, how does Islam look in India compared to in other Muslim countries, blah, blah, blah. So it's important, not just in a sense of security policy, diplomacy, that sort of thing, but also even more in the context of trade. So yes, absolutely. And then separately, ordinary people, for many of the same reasons, know much more now than they did. And I don't want to say that generally speaking, ordinary people know a lot about world religions because they don't, at least not in this country. And Pew, actually, you mentioned Pew. Pew has done two waves of a study of religious literacy in the U.S., and it's actually pretty bad. Like, people don't know as much about world religions as you might think or you might expect, or from my standpoint, you might hope. But that said, I'm sure that we know more than we did back in my grandparents' day or my great grandparents' day, simply because there's more information available, right? Whether that information's always trustworthy online, et cetera, is a whole other matter. But, you know, we're more aware now, and that would be true in other countries as well, as we would have been a century, two centuries ago.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Laura Olson. She is the past president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. And I would say this, Laura, that our organization, Interfaith Dialogue Association, we do a variety of different things in conjunction with our parent organization, the Kauffman Interfaith Institute. One of those things that we do is we have a speakers bureau made up of a variety of people who are expert presenters on their own faiths. So not only do they understand how to explain a faith, they actually practice that faith. To be on our speakers bureau, right? You have to know your stuff and do your stuff. And over the past 20 years, the number of world religions classes in middle school, high school, and college has been phenomenal, and has kept us quite busy over these past few years. So I get real excited when I realize that kids are being exposed, and not only are they being exposed to textbooks and perhaps the bias, if there is any, in a teacher, but they're actually able, at least in this instance, to hear from a real life Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Jew, whomever we happen to send out. And the response is almost 100% positive. People enjoy that. We also encourage tours. So we work with the synagogues, the mosques, and the gurdwaras, and the Hindu temple, and all of that to arrange people to actually visit. So I think, yeah, this is something that wouldn't have happened en masse a generation ago. So
you are correct. And, I mean, when I was growing up, I'm 53. And when I was growing up, in the public schools, of course, there's a lot to negotiate around what happens and doesn't happen around teaching about religion. But even in high school, we learned nothing in a systematic way.
You know, I was going to touch on that a little later on, but since you brought it up, one of the things about education, public education, is obviously we have a separation of church and state, and so schools are allowed to do some things but not others. Over the years, I've seen two movements. First of all, about 20 years ago or so, I saw a lot of schools sort of go in the direction of fear, meaning we can't even... If the janitor stubs his toe, whatever he comes out of his mouth, it can't be God. It's that serious. We have to have that hardcore separation. No Bible studies after school, anything like that. And then, if I recall correctly, it was during the Clinton administration that there was clarification. Like, no. We don't want teachers, leading the Lord's Prayer in front of gym class or anything. But you can do A, B, C, and D. And now we have this pushback from more conservative edges of our society that they really want significant religious expression in the schools. And Trump was even saying that, I'm going to give that to you. We don't have to worry about this, that, or the other thing anymore. And I'm curious, where do you see public education and religion right now?
That's a heck of a good question. It what you just described is absolutely true, that there was for a time after the landmark decisions in the early 60s that the U.S. Supreme Court came down and said no prayer in school, made it very, very clear that that was a thing of the past. So and many school districts and many schools themselves have to be quite concerned about sort of what are the limits of the law. If my dad was an elementary school principal, and so one thing that he had to, he resolved it pretty quickly, but there was a church, like a new congregation that didn't have a place to meet yet, and they came and asked him whether they could use his school building on Sunday morning, right? So, is that okay? What does the district say about that, et cetera, et cetera? What's happened is that since Engel versus Vitale, which is the big, important first case saying that school prayer was unconstitutional, Right. Lawyers and courts have, and scholars have looked at what that precedent means. And instead, and this is true of so many other areas of jurisprudence, what kinds of specific questions might arise pursuant to that precedent? And the longer the precedent sits around, the more different, let's say, school districts or states might say, well, what about this scenario? And then, right, you bring suit and you see, does the Supreme Court have any inclination to rule on whatever the issue is? So we've gotten to the point now where just because of that natural process over the course of, let me think if I can do math, 60 years now, wow, since Engle, almost 60 years since Engle, right, there's been this negotiation, right, that's happened around, is it okay? Okay, prayer in school isn't okay, but what about a moment of silence, right? Or what about prayer before school starts around the flag pole, if students lead it? And if students are leading it, can teachers come and participate voluntarily or not, right? So all these narrow little questions emerge. And obviously there's been changes in the personnel on the courts, not just the Supreme Court, but further down, et cetera, et cetera. But bottom line right now is that the court as it exists right now, and this is not just because of the three new Trump appointees, the court's moved a little bit more in the direction of accommodation around religious practice, that, okay, you don't have to, to use your janitor example, you don't have to prevent people from ever uttering the word God, let's say. We can expand the boundaries of what's okay. And so it is the case that schools, right, it's more about asking, can this specific thing happen? And then you go ahead and you have this specific thing happen. And then if there's a legal challenge to it, you deal with that if it arises. So, but it is very much the case that there's been more acceptance of, I mean, and not in every particular city, state, or school district, but there's been more acceptance of a little bit more latitude for students in particular, especially in high school, too, because by then they're not 6 years old. They can think for themselves, which is a big, important thing that the courts have looked at over a period of time. That said, there is still, so even though there's a little bit more latitude now than there would have been in, let's say, 1970, it is also the case that in our polarized society, right, everything takes on political meaning, and everything ends up being a matter of, are you on my side or are you on the other side? And one thing that falls under that sort of rubric right now is religious freedom. And that there's actually a whole separate story around the politicization of the concept of religious freedom. So there's this perception on the part of people on both sides that there's either too much religion or not enough religion. And there's very little effort, I think, on the part of both sides to say, hey, you know, how, is there a place in the middle where we can agree? Like, this is okay for students to do outside the context of being in class. And instead of just saying, you know, too much or not enough, right, folks tend not to look at specific details.
And how about the idea of studying about religion? So, for instance, mm-hmm. I just mentioned that there are world religions classes in public schools, and we send speakers there. Above and beyond religion, world religion classes, how do you study Western civilization and not bring up the a particular carpenter from Palestine a couple thousand years ago, or how do you talk about Asia without talking about Siddhartha, who became the Buddha? How do you do that? I find it to be virtually impossible.
Exactly. So especially once you get to, you know, high school age. Little kids is a whole separate matter, but when you get to high school age, of course you can't, right? You have to understand, because if we're going to understand culture, we have to understand religion. If we want to understand conflict, we have to understand religion and differences therein. And so it depends, obviously, on the teacher. It depends on the flexibility of his or her curriculum, the extent to which they can pull these things in. But the bottom line, and teachers know this, they absolutely know this, that it has to be the study of religion from a historical standpoint or in the context of literature, right? Like you could read a book of the Bible as an example of literature, like say Song of Solomon, or we in high school, we read the book Siddhartha in English class. And so you learn about, right, by Hermann Hesse, but not, right, but you learn, right, via literature. You learn via history, and instead of sort of having it be any kind of indoctrination, right, this religion is better than another religion, the law very clearly specifies that teachers have to say, so this is a thing that exists, right? This is an entity that is part of society, and we are not going to say that one is better than another, one is preferable than another, etc. So, and just like with anything in human life, some teachers, of course, are going to be better equipped to do that than others. But it's very, very important that students, and this is part of how this whole area of law has developed. It's one thing for a student who is old enough to more or less think for themselves to be exposed to, here are the different world religions, and this is interesting, and it's an important piece of history, et cetera, versus younger kids who are impressionable. And, right, the court has remained quite clear, right, but not just the Supreme Court, but all the courts have remained quite clear that littler kids, right, little kids, the less you expose them to religion, the better you are going to end up being on constitutional grounds.
Well, Laura, this is all very fascinating, and I have more questions for you, particularly on education. So we're down to the wire for this episode, but I'm hoping you'll join us next week.
Absolutely. Be delighted to.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Dr. Laura Olson, past president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, has been our guest and will be next week. Please join us on WGVU.